You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko otoutoku ingoa. Nau mai hare mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Ra'apa Wednesday. I'm your host Otto and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined by producer Max. E whai aki nei coming up on the show for our weekly catch-up with the Green Party. We spoke to MP Huhana Linden about how the government's $200 million gas exploration investment breaches the agreement on climate change, trade and sustainability. We'll be talking about how Shane Jones drafting a members bill forcing Ngāpuhi into a single commercial settlement. And we'll be talking about the Greens' call to the government to condemn the recent US strikes on Iran. I also speak to retired politics and international relations professor at the University of Auckland, Stephen Hoadley, for a follow-up conversation about the Iranian strikes and their potential impacts on global oil prices. And I speak to Professor of Māori Studies at the University of Auckland, Margaret Mutu, for another conversation about Shane Jones's Ngāpuhi settlement bill. Max, what have you got for us today?
I speak with Anna Elders, a mental health nurse practitioner, to discuss how GPs and nurse practitioners will be able to start medical treatment for adults with ADHD. And I also speak to Will Appleby, a freshwater campaigner at Greenpeace Aotearoa, to discuss the latest groundwater data published by Stats NZ.
He aha o whakaro. I'd love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātui mai texan on 5395 or waia mai rāne. Give us a call in the studio on 309-3879. Kaua e ware ware e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ēne kōrero. Ano he pakiheri rokiroki marunga I te pai tukutuku o irirangi pōho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the Green Party.
Recently, the Green Party commissioned independent legal advice to look into the government's $200 million investment into new gas fields that was carried out last month and found out that the investment was in breach of the Agreement on Climate Change, Trade and Sustainability. Also, NZ First MP Shane Jones recently announced that he'd be drafting a members' bill to force Ngāpuhi into a single commercial settlement, which would prevent Hapū from negotiating separate commercial redresses and removing any reference to Hapū sovereignty from the settlement terms. And the Green Party recently issued calls to the New Zealand government to condemn the recent US strikes on Iranian nuclear facilities, almost a week after Iran and Israel had both been trading missile strikes between one another. For our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke with MP Huhana Linden to get the party's take on all of these issues.
Can you tell us about the independent advice the Green Party commissioned, its findings, and what this means for the agreement?
Yeah, well, we commissioned the King's Council to look into the issue because in an understanding, you know, that the government had put aside $200 million to pay to the private sector for new gas field exploration, it was quite shocking once we understood that actually it was a breach of the trade agreements that are already in place. And, you know, knowing that Todd McClay only just released and signed the New Zealand trade deal with Costa Rica, Iceland, Switzerland last year, within 6 months, we've already breached that trade agreement. So what's that about?
So what could be the potential consequences of the government breaching this agreement through that investment?
Yeah, well, we're calling for answers right now, and we're not getting clear answers in terms of, well, first of all, you say that you care about energy security and regional resilience. Okay, so what does that look like in terms of renewable energy? Then you've set aside this $200 million to open up more exploration of gas fields, and we're asking the government to recall this fossil fuel handout that they're giving, because we need to focus on things that actually make a positive difference in our community. And it's certainly not gas exploration. We don't need any more of that in New Zealand.
How could violating this agreement impact our relationships with partnering countries that also signed the agreement?
Yeah, we've asked those questions right now in terms of what is the response when we know that we've breached this trade agreement with these countries, knowing that, you know, we have to make commitments on the international stage. And then we're opening up for other companies to come into New Zealand for further gas exploration in Aotearoa. And, you know, we're not against, of course, you know, working with business, but we need to be looking at energy, sustainability, resilience, and what's good for our regions. And we know that this gas exploration priority really undermines so many fundamentals in climate change and the way that our regions are reflected in investment. And, of course, now we've got that breach.
When the investment was initially made, Shane Jones said that natural gas exploration was critical for delivering secure and affordable energy for New Zealanders. How would you respond to that?
No, I think that's debatable. Matua Shane says many things, and I think the people of New Zealand deserve to have absolutely sustainable and secure energy, but ultimately that requires us to really take a look at the way that the government is prioritising industries and with the gas. You know, like, do we need more of that in Taranaki? Just saying. We've got already Trans-Tasman resources. They're under attack as it is from the local community. We don't want any more of this in our communities. And Regional Council just stood and toe-suckled our local iwi and community opposition on these matters. So, you know, is the government going to listen? We'll wait and see.
And what would be a better use of public funds to make energy more affordable?
Oh, well, you know, if we think about the energy resilience that we could have, it would be investing in, you know, more solar panels from public buildings. Let's look at the way that we could harness Ngāhihi or Kamanui Pera. We're really committed to the way with which we can use the dollar, but providing energy resilience in communities is something that we all benefit from, and there's many ways to use the dollar. It's not just in gas exploration and inviting in these external international companies to New Zealand.
All right, moving on to the next topic. NZ First MP Shane Jones recently announced that he'd be drafting a members' bill to force Ngāpuhi into a single commercial settlement. Under the proposal, Hapū would be prevented from negotiating separate commercial redresses, and any reference to Hapū sovereignty would be removed from the settlement terms. So my next question is, what was the Green Party's reaction to Shane Jones's announcement?
Yeah, absolutely shocked, but not surprised. Shane Jones has been vocal in this matter in the campaign trail in 2023, and now he's following through. Now, Ngāhapū o Ngāpuhi are very clear in terms of what are bottom lines, and Tino Rangatiratanga is one of them, which was affirmed by the Waitangi Tribunal in their Stage 1 report, known as Te Paparahi o Tiraki, where they affirmed that Ngāhapū o Ngāpuhi did not cede sovereignty. So that's something that the government needs to come to grips with and come to the table to discuss in a meaningful way in order for conversations on settlement to take place now and into the future.
How do you expect this announcement and Shane Jones's members' bill to impact relations between the Crown and iwi?
Oh, it's impacting right now. There's an allergic reaction across the north as Ngāhapū o Ngāpuhi. They're very clear that, you know, if we want to enter into negotiations, it needs to be on agreement and terms that are beneficial for all parties. You can't just go and make these directions upon Hapū groups when they already know that they want to move according to their own tikanga. This should not be a directive of the Crown. And that's, you know, one of the problems that we've got in this situation, is that we've got a minister basically setting out the terms as to how it's going to go. And Ngāpuhi's already stood against that in the past, and they'll continue to stand against it today.
While speaking to the media, Shane Jones said that the process of settling the Ngāpuhi claim had cost the government millions of dollars with, quote, nothing to show for it, and then further said that sovereignty was a diversion the New Zealand taxpayer could not afford to pay for. How would you respond to that?
The investment itself is something that each government needs to own in terms of the way that they have mishandled Ngāhapū o Ngāpuhi. Governments have come and governments have gone, and they've continued to push a particular bent that does not suit our tribes. And so we are very clear, it will be Hapū-led according to our own tikanga. It will not be led by a minister with his own views on how Ngāpuhi should negotiate and settle claims.
And how will the Greens respond if Shane Jones's bill is introduced to Parliament?
We will go into community, we will listen to the Hapū, and we will stand in solidarity. Wherever the Hapū takes us, we will listen and we will act.
All right, moving on to the last topic. The Green Party recently issued a call to the government to condemn the U.S. strikes on Iranian nuclear facilities. This comes after Iran and Israel had both been trading missile strikes at one another throughout the course of the previous week. So next, I'd like to ask, can you tell us about the Greens' call to the government and why they should condemn the United States for their strikes on Iran?
It's not okay what's happening over there, and really aroha for all sides of this. But, you know, there's no use in having those from the U.S. going in heavy-handed and trying to, you know, execute a ceasefire or peace according to, again, their own tikanga and imposing themselves in terms of what that looks like. When we saw the bombings, it was hard to watch, knowing that, you know, these are communities, these are people, and we shouldn't be taking this approach in international relations. So, yeah, it is important that as New Zealand, as citizens of the world, that we do say, no, enough is enough. We do need a ceasefire. We need to stop this type of behaviour and come to the table together to really address what's going on here. And so, you know, I pay tribute to Marama Davidson and Chloe in the way that they have stood up and said, no, come on, New Zealand. We need to get in behind peace, and we need to push for peace at an executive level. We've got the Prime Minister in NATO right now. You know, come on, let's push as a country. We don't have to just sit silently and watch this happen.
2 days ago, Foreign Minister Winston Peters and Defence Minister Judith Collins both issued a joint statement calling on all parties to return to talks and stressing the need for diplomacy. Do you think that this is enough?
We think that we need to be really overt in our calls for peace, and I think that there's an opportunity for us to strengthen the way that we vocalise this. And now that, you know, we have the Prime Minister overseas in these talks, is to take leadership on the matter and to go out there with strength and call for the ceasefire to come to the table together and look for workable solutions. But, you know, what's happening to Iran is not okay. And we cannot forget and be distracted knowing what's happening in Palestine. The people in Palestine are still there and still seeking food, aid, and as a country and as, you know, members of society and the world, we need to be stronger on these matters.
And lastly, do you think that there's a possibility that New Zealand could get dragged into a wider regional conflict if things escalate?
Well, you know, that's one of the risks, certainly we're calling for peace. We're calling for a ceasefire to stop the shooting, stop the bombs, all of it, and come back to the table with some common sense. And I think, you know, as New Zealand, we can do that. We can take leadership in our region, and we shouldn't wait for others. This is an opportunity for us to take leadership on the world stage.
And that was the Green Party's Huhana Linden speaking to us about the government's breach of the ACCTS with their $200 million gas exploration investment, Shane Jones's members bill forcing Ngāpuhi into a single commercial settlement, and the Greens' call to the government to condemn the recent US strikes on Iran.
That was our weekly chat with the Green Party.
I don't kiss men.
Huwaya.
But I kissed him.
Following our previous conversation with Huhana Linden, we had a follow-up conversation with retired politics and international relations professor at the University of Auckland, Stephen Hoadley, about the recent US strikes on Iran and their potential impacts on oil prices and the global economy. Stephen says that should Iran close the Strait of Hormuz, through which a third of the world's natural gas and almost 25% of total global oil consumption travels, a massive spike in oil prices could be expected. We also spoke about the legality of the strikes themselves and their impacts on the region's building tensions.
Can you tell us about the economic impacts that are likely to come about as a result of these strikes?
Well, the feared economic impact of the closure of the Hormuz Strait has not happened. That is, the Iranian parliament has authorized the Iranian leadership to close the strait, but the leadership has chosen not to do so. So the anticipated rise in oil prices has not happened. In fact, at the petrol pump, you may find that your petrol prices are stable, maybe even coming down slightly. The stock market is up. Consequently, the airstrikes, although they initially put the stock market down and the fuel prices up, Brent crude, for example, went up from $73 to $76 a barrel, and some were predicting $80 a barrel, even $100 a barrel. It hasn't happened. So the cessation of hostilities has transcended the airstrikes, and consequently At the moment, we don't really fear any economic consequences.
Can you tell us about the Strait of Hormuz and why it's so important?
It's only 33 kilometers wide. It's about the size of the English Channel, for example, but much of it is shallows, and the shipping lanes in either direction are only 3 kilometers, and there are some 760 ships. Oil tankers, basically, and liquefied natural gas tankers and others in the Persian Gulf at any given time. Now, given the tensions between Israel and Iran, the number of ships has declined. It's now below 700. Many ships have declined to go into because they'd be afraid they would be bottled up. That is, the Straits of Hormuz is a cork in a bottle, and the Iranians can easily close it off with their fast patrol boats armed with heavy machine guns and RPGs. They've got short-range missiles. They've got artillery that can reach the strait from the shore of Iran. And they have their military methods to close off the straits. Well, so far it isn't happening. And that's the good news, is that the Iranians have exercised amazing restraint. They sent missiles to attack the Al Abeid air base in Doha, in Qatar, but they gave advance notice, and all of those missiles, save one, were shot down by interceptors. You know, the one that got through did not cause any damage. So Iranian pride is satisfied. They can now go to the negotiating table feeling that they have given tit for tat to the United States. And all this is very good news for my point of view.
If Iran was to hypothetically close the Strait of Hormuz in response to the growing regional tensions, would that be a violation of international law and international trade agreements?
Well, very good point, Otto. It would indeed. Look, the international law of the sea, the United Nations Law of the Sea Convention, designates international waterways. The Cook Strait, for example, is one. We could not close off the Cook Strait unless there were a dire emergency, and we would challenge international convention. So the Strait of Hormuz is an international waterway. It would be illegal, even though Oman and Iran together it's internal waters and territorial waters for those two countries. But international law would prohibit that. This is a waterway of benefit to all to all humankind, to innocent commerce. Particularly 20% of the world's oil and gas supplies pass through that very narrow strait. And certainly the Chinese government is bringing a certain amount of pressure to Iran to say, hang on a minute, look, 90% of our oil comes through that choke point to China. And if you close it off and Chinese ships or Chinese-bound ships cannot get through, you know, we're going to have a serious shortage of energy. So there's lots of pressure being brought to bear on the Iranians, and so far they seem to be doing the prudent thing, which is to back off, to not continue the conflict. This allows the Israelis then to stop their bombardment and attacks of Iranian targets. And maybe we will have a few days of relative calm.
Regarding the strikes themselves, Trump has received criticism from both the Democrats and his own cabinet for initiating the strikes without congressional approval. Were these strikes unconstitutional under U.S. law?
No, they are legal under U.S. law. The commander-in-chief is the president. He can move the armed forces. He can use them any way he wants. Temporarily. Now, there is the War Powers Act. It was passed way back in the prior century. It allows, it obliges the president to report to the Congress, and Congress, after a cooling off period, can actually pass a resolution to stop the use of military force by the president. Well, that's never been invoked. The successive presidents have said it is not constitutional. It violates the Constitution in the sense that the president is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. So Congress has never been successful. They have invoked it, but not successfully. And President Trump, of course, we know is bending the rules, is transcending the boundaries of congressional restraint. and it has no intention of ceasing to use initiatives in the military sense. So in that sense, the Democrats can complain. The Republicans remain cowardly silent on what their president is doing. And Donald Trump essentially has a free rein to do what he thinks he wants to do.
How likely is it that the current ceasefire between Israel and Iran will last?
I'm optimistic it will last for a while. Look, both sides have depleted their ammunition. The Iranians have used up their long-range artillery, their long-range missiles. The Israelis have used up their air defense missiles. Both will want to replenish and regroup and repair damage. And it's in the interest of both sides because Netanyahu, I read this morning, has declared victory. He said, look, we've accomplished all of our objectives in Iran. We've stopped the nuclear program. I hope we can say a word about that in a minute. We've curbed Iran's military capacity and its ability to rain down rockets on Israel. So therefore, we're happy to, if the Iranians show restraint, we're happy to show restraint, and then some kind of peace talks, or at least stability talks, will ensue from that. They have not yet begun. Neither side's agreed to it, but at least the missiles and the attacks have ceased, at least today, and we hope in the next few days, until diplomacy then can take hold and serious talks about where to go next can be initiated.
And going off of that, have these strikes brought an end to Iran's nuclear program, as Netanyahu seems to be claiming?
Brilliant question, Otto. And now I've got the New Zealand Herald in front of me for this morning, and I'm going to read a couple of phrases from it. And we start with, of course, Donald Trump completely obliterated. And that phrase then has been repeated by J.D. and Carolyn Leavitt, the spokesperson for the administration, and all of the Trumpists in the United States. On the other hand, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staffs has indicated, well, look, there's no real, that'll damage assessment will take days, even weeks. An expert says there's no real way to conduct a thorough damage assessment, that the centrifuges have probably significantly been damaged, but we don't know. Others have said that the program is set back maybe 2 or 3 years. This is the Israeli assessment. So, yes, we can say that there's been substantial delay to the nuclear program, but other experts are saying, look, the 400 kilograms of enriched uranium hexafluoride in gaseous form could be put into high-pressure containers and put it onto trucks and taken to secret sites, maybe even taken to Pakistan, which is friendly, one of the few friendly governments towards Iran, and process further there. And so it is possible that within a year that Iran could have a nuclear explosive device. Whether it's battle-ready, no. It will not be able to be militarized, to be put on a missile and sent to Israel. So we're still some ways away from that. So that's the big question everybody has. Where is that 400 kilograms of enriched, 60% enriched uranium gas? Can it be processed further, made into a fissile package, and can the Iranians achieve a nuclear explosion? So that's what we'll have to be talking about sometime in the future, Otto.
And that was Stefan Hoadley, a retired associate professor from the University of Auckland, talking to us about the recent U.S. strikes on Iran and their potential impacts on the global economy. We'll be right back after a quick break. Keep it on the B.
95.
You enough to not say every word I'm feeling right now. I'm questioning my feelings right now, 'cause you used to say that you care, now you're barely there. I feel like your last priority, but you call me needy. I get paid more than I see you, and I don't even have
Harmonia is doing another performance of that famous guy's music.
Who?
You know that guy? Ba 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 ba.
Oh, he looks kind of grumpy in that painting.
Beethoven!
The Auckland Philharmonia plays Beethoven's iconic Fifth Symphony at the Auckland Town Hall, Wednesday, June 25th at 6:30. For tickets and more info, go to aucklandphil.nz.
Check out the coolest exhibition at New Zealand Maritime Museum, Hui Te Ananui a Tangaroa, Into Ocean and Ice. Go on a polar journey to Antarctica and experience five artists' interpretations of the fragile beauty of this epic landscape. From Ernest Shackleton's heroic expeditions to the climate-threatened island of South Georgia. Into Ocean and Ice, on now until August 31st, 2025. Free entry with museum admission. For more info, go to maritimemuseum.co.nz.
Auckland Museum presents live at the museum with the legendary lineup Shefu and the Crates, Laao, and Geneva AM this Friday.
Join the Auckland Museum as Mataniki and Puanga rise and celebrate the sounds on Tamaki's very own doorstep.
Live at the museum with Shefu and the Crates, Laao, and Geneva AM. This Friday starting at 7:30 p.m. Get your tickets now from AucklandMuseum.com.
Hey, want to get in on this buzz?
Well, well, well. What's the buzz?
Good question, actually.
Hey, does anyone know?
Oh, that is a good question.
Right.
Yeah, to think on that.
Should we come through?
Some reference.
Yeah, we've
got something to do with me.
I think Hayden might know.
Find out what the buzz is by tuning in to What's the Buzz on 95 BFM Breakfast with the rotating cast of experts from the New Zealand Drug Foundation bringing fresh news from the world of drugs, including weird shit to watch out for and tips for staying safer.
What's the Buzz on 95 BFM Breakfast? Thanks to the New Zealand Drug Foundation.
Brought to you by thelevel.org.nz. Straight up drug info.
Bon appetit, 95 BFM listeners. We've just brewed up a combo of hot tunes and cold beers.
That's right. Drive Island at the Beer Spot Morningside is back, Friday, June 27. Come hang out, have a cold one, and watch some live performances by two iconic bands. Boom! And Cindy.
95 BFM Drive Island at the Beer Spot Morningside, Friday,
Friday, June 27th from 4 till 7 p.m. With thanks to McLeod's Brewery, The Beer Spot and New Zealand On Air.
Children eat worms and bugs and all sorts of things when they crawl in around.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309 3879. From February 2026, GPs and nurse practitioners in Aotearoa will be able to start medical treatments for adults with ADHD. It's a move that could drastically reduce long wait times while improving access to care. Mental health experts say the change is a big step forward for adults in New Zealand who are particularly vulnerable to falling through administration gaps. Anna Elders is a mental health nurse practitioner and a specialist in ADHD. I spoke with Anna to talk about what the change means and why it could change the way primary care supports mental health in Aotearoa. To start off, what was your first reaction to this news?
Well, I wasn't surprised by it because I've been working in with the group behind the scenes with PharmEca and MedSafe working to, you know, think about how we were going to do this to raise access and improve outcomes for people with ADHD. So when it was finally announced, I was there, I'm absolutely thrilled for the ADHD community and our mental health sector and our communities here in Aotearoa across the board, really.
Could you explain what's changing and why it matters for people with ADHD?
Yeah, so I think the biggest change that this will bring is that the ability to catch up with someone, where you're catching up with them and in what timely manner is going to shift to allow primary care to do more of the work that they need to be doing in this space, because we're currently relying on what we term specialist services, which are often either in secondary mental health services or private practice, which the majority of New Zealanders can't access. And thus we're seeing these massive challenges in gaining access to diagnosis and specific treatments like medication. So by doing what we need to do and what's already happening with other mental health challenges or conditions and moving more of the ability for primary care to do more of the work, it's just gonna remove the major obstacles that are there.
Why do you think there's been more of a push for GPs to be more involved in diagnosing and treating ADHD?
So it's not just GPs. We're also talking about a really other important workforce that is currently being underutilised, and that's nurse practitioners, both in primary care that work alongside and do similar roles to GPs in that general practice space, as well as mental health and child and adolescent mental health nurse practitioners that are working alongside psychiatrists and paediatricians in those similar roles. I think the importance of it really is if we're looking at the number of people that need support to the number of specialists we have, the number of psychiatrists and paediatricians, where the weight's fallen on them and where those guys are often employed. So much like diabetes used to be surprisingly a condition that was only treated by specialist endocrinologists and specialist services, you know, that shifted to GPs taking over, and that was quite a change. And there was a lot of resistance initially whether or not GPs could manage a condition like diabetes, but now it's a given. So there's a lot of work that's going to be needed to get our primary care teams up and running with the expertise, the ability to undertake the really comprehensive assessments that's needed to get the diagnosis right, to understand the different treatment pathways. But so that's going to be the next step of work that's going to happen. Some of those GPs and primary care nurse practitioners will have some specialist knowledge already, but that's where we're going to be heading from now, and it will really open up to just that closer to home, easy to access support that people with ADHD need.
Can you explain what the current process is for getting an ADHD diagnosis in New Zealand?
Yeah, so like I said, at the moment there's a heavy reliance on psychologists, some of those guys working in the educational psychology space, especially for kids, clinical psychologists, registered psychologists, and within psychology, to some degree there can be supervision around getting that diagnosis sort of confirmed by, say, clinical psychologists in some cases. And then there is also the ability to see a psychiatrist, which may be child or an adult psychiatrist, paediatricians, and mental health nurse practitioners that work both in an adult or a child and adolescent space. So the process is really rigorous, or you know, a good assessment is. It starts off with catching up with people, often for at least an hour and a half, and having an initial assessment. There's a whole bunch of different screenings and psychometric measures that are done, because you're not just looking to diagnose ADHD. What you're really trying to do is identify what are the challenges and how could they be best explained. So you've got to be looking at physical health conditions that may explain some of the issues people are having, that may be instead of ADHD or alongside, you also looking at a whole range of other conditions that again could be happening alongside ADHD, making it more challenging, or could explain the challenges instead of it being ADHD. So you're really going through a process of rolling in and rolling out, looking over time as well. So you're looking back into childhood, have the challenges been present before adolescence, you know, in those earlier years, are they still there, and are they present across a range of domains? At home, work, you know, and social life. So it really is quite a rigorous process before you can arrive and sort of work with someone to sort of confirm that, yep, this is ADHD, or actually it may look like it, but it's in fact not. It could be explained in a different way.
You've mentioned that the shift will reduce delays and save money. How significant are the current wait times, and what difference will it make to have the GPs prescribing directly?
So there's a couple of parts to this. One is around where people are going along for an actual initial assessment. Some people have the diagnosis already, whether it's in childhood or they may have had that diagnosis made by a psychologist who can't prescribe. So this change is going to be really significant for those guys. They'll no longer have to see a psychiatrist or a paediatrician. There are GPs out there who may not quite have their diagnostic skills up, but we have worked with ADHD and been prescribing in primary care after a psychiatrist or a paediatrician may have started medication, and those guys will be able to do a lot more of the work in supporting changes in medications, dose increases, or restarting people that haven't been on meds for a long time, who were maybe kids who were diagnosed and are struggling as adults now and want to, you know, retry stimulants. The other part of it, with people that are coming first time for a diagnosis, is going to be the more complex, lengthier part for benefit. And there will also be challenges that our healthcare system and, you know, primary care system, particularly in PHOs, are going to have to work through around cost. What we really don't want to see is that we get a continued sort of payment for this. There really needs to be an onus on how can we have some funded or certainly subsidised assessments that's happening in primary care, because the massive challenge at the moment is for a lot of people in private is cost. So there are going to be definitely things to iron out, but I think there's enough of a cost saving and social investment impact that, you know, hopefully there'll be some good thinking around the need to spend some money in health to support ADHD, to save money longer term across a whole range of different sectors that we're currently spending resources on, whether it's through the justice system, you know, police, social services, drug and alcohol, where, you know, people struggle with the ongoing consequences of living undiagnosed with ADHD or, you know, not optimally supported.
What is the risk of overdiagnosis or misdiagnosis if GPs and nurse practitioners play a larger role in ADHD assessments?
So overdiagnosis, look, I mean, you could look at it from the challenge of starting someone on a stimulant and it not being the right approach because they don't have ADHD. Obviously, stimulants come with their risks, but you're screening people very carefully around those and not, you're being very cautious for anyone who would have added risks of, say, having a, you know, a heart attack in response or some really significant adverse reaction. Most people, when they start stimulants, you know, their response will identify if they're helpful or not. And although that doesn't cement that you've got the diagnosis right, it certainly can be quite reassuring as a prescriber. But the other thing around misdiagnosis, so we know that we've got a whole bunch of people out there with ADHD who have only ever been diagnosed with depression, sometimes treatment-resistant depression or anxiety disorders, or even things like bipolar, where actually they are the misdiagnoses, or it might be their depression or anxiety is secondary to the ADHD they've lived with for years and years that's never been picked up, and their depression isn't shifting or improving or responding to antidepressants because, you know, it's that dopamine they need so much support with rather than serotonin. So I think we've got a much bigger problem of misdiagnosis and underdiagnosis of ADHD at the moment that we're trying to address. The challenges of overdiagnosing ADHD in the future, I think, is far less of an issue and less risky, but this is what we're going to be carefully looking at as this rolls out and monitoring.
Do you see this as a step towards broader changes towards improving care for other conditions like OCD, bipolar disorder and anxiety?
Absolutely. So, you know, I've worked as a mental health specialist and for a reasonable amount of that time as a nurse practitioner, so prescribing and diagnosing alongside, colleagues who are psychiatrists working in that primary care space. We just don't have the specialism in primary care that we need. We've got some fantastic GPs and primary care nurse practitioners who can do a great job with mental health. They don't get the time, they don't get the training and that full ability to identify other conditions properly like OCD and bipolar, especially where it's complex. And so we have such undetected rates of things like social anxiety, OCD. We have misdiagnosis of things like bipolar, even borderline personality disorder, and those really stigmatising conditions because we're just not doing proper screenings for things like ADHD and conditions like PTSD. So a proper training program will see GPs and primary care nurse practitioners who want to develop a specialist practice in this in general care like they do with skin cancers or other specialist areas that GPs can step into. They'll have to get their heads around not just diagnosing ADHD, they'll have to learn what those other conditions look like because they've got to either be able to rule those in or out. So what you're doing by helping GPs train up with ADHD is that they will have to get better or not better, they'll have to fine-tune, upskill in being able to better detect a whole range of conditions and know what to treat and support. So you are, if this is done properly, we're going to see an improvement in how primary care mental health can support our populations. 11 years at the moment is the current time it takes for someone to get diagnosed with OCD. That's the delay from the condition presenting itself to when someone gets diagnosed. 11 years is a long time. You know, it's similar for other conditions. So we need to do something about that. And I think this is potentially will support some of that wider improvement too.
That was Anna Elders speaking about the upcoming changes to ADHD and treatment in primary care.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire.
Newly released data from Stats NZ, taken between 2019 and 2024, has revealed a growing crisis. Almost half of New Zealand's monitored groundwater sites have shown contamination levels that exceed national health standards. The findings raise several concerns about the safety of New Zealand's drinking water, particularly in rural communities. The data shows particularly high levels of both E. coli and nitrate. Both have been linked to serious health risks, with nitrate contamination being linked to certain cancers and preterm births. This comes just weeks after the government's proposed changes that would further roll back freshwater protections. To talk about the latest Stats NZ report, I spoke to Will Appleby, a freshwater campaigner at Greenpeace Aotearoa, to discuss what these figures mean and why he believes the government is putting public health at risk. Can you talk about what the new groundwater data shows and why is it so alarming?
Yeah, so during that period, 45% of monitoring sites exceeded the health limits for E. coli and 12.4% exceeded those limits for nitrates. And that's a contaminant that's been linked to cancer and preterm births. And these are alarming figures. And in fact, the data for nitrates shows that almost half of those monitoring sites are likely or very likely increasing. So this is a growing crisis, a growing drinking water crisis. And instead of safeguarding public health, Christopher Luxon and his government are changing the rules to weaken freshwater protections. And this will benefit big dairy as a result.
Could you go into who is being affected by this at the moment?
Yeah, so In terms of nitrate, it's typically rural communities that are most impacted. 80% of the country has access to drinking water below 1 milligram per litre, which is considered safe. But it should be, the principle should be that it shouldn't matter where you live in Aotearoa, everyone should have access to safe drinking water. But that isn't the reality for many people. Typically those in rural communities.
And I know you already went into it a little bit, but could you just summarise the risks of E. coli and nitrate pollution?
Sure. So, I mean, E. coli can result in hospitalisation in some cases. Nitrate has a number of health risks. The main one that most people are aware of is blue baby syndrome. This is a condition where the baby's blood is starved of oxygen. And it's because of blue baby syndrome that the health limit for nitrate is set at 11.3 milligrams per litre. But that was set in the 1950s, and it doesn't take into account the newer health science around nitrate contamination in drinking water, which shows that there are risks of cancer and preterm birth at much lower levels. In fact, at long-term exposure to nitrate in drinking water above 1 milligram per litre could increase the risk of bowel cancer by 4%. But the current health limits don't take into account these other health risks.
Like you said, the current maximum allowable value for nitrate was set in the 1950s. Would you say that those standards need to be updated, and if so, how?
Absolutely. We should be taking a precautionary approach, which we currently aren't. There is a risk of colorectal cancer at levels above 1 milligram per litre. The New Zealand College of Midwives actually recommends to pregnant people that if their water is above 5 milligrams per litre, they should consider finding another source of water because there could be a risk of preterm birth. And these are levels much lower than the current maximum allowable value, which is 11.3. So they should be updated, and it's frustrating that they haven't been.
Greenpeace Aotearoa has described the government as prioritising industry over public health. Could you explain this?
Yeah, so the government is currently consulting on a range of proposals that would roll back a number of freshwater protections. They've already rolled back some of them last year. The current proposals that they've put forward include scrapping the cap on synthetic nitrogen fertiliser, which is currently set at 190 kilograms per hectare. This rule exists to prevent further nitrate contamination and to protect people's health. But Luxon and his government, they want to get rid of it. They've also proposed giving more of a prioritisation to corporate uses of water, like intensive dairy, and that will come at the expense of safe drinking water and healthy rivers. So that should be the priority, healthy rivers and ecosystems and safe drinking water. But what they're currently proposing is to give more of a prioritisation to those corporate uses of water. And this will just put more power in the hands of intensive dairy, which is causing much of this pollution.
And my final question would be, what solutions does Greenpeace Aotearoa want to see implemented to ensure clean drinking water for all in New Zealand?
Yeah, so the government needs to stop meddling with freshwater protections, and it needs to get its hands off freshwater protections, because clearly this data shows that we have a growing crisis when it comes to safe drinking water. But we need to go further as well. Everybody, no matter where they should live in New Zealand, should have access to safe drinking water and should be able to swim in their local rivers without getting sick. And that's currently not the case for many communities. The science is clear, and the stakes are high, and it's time that Luxon and his Canada colleagues decided to govern for people rather than intensive dairy, because we've seen already the influence that the agriculture sector has over this government. We've seen that last year in the rollback of freshwater protections, and we're seeing that now with these current proposals. So it's time that Luxon governed for people and protected their health.
And that was Will Appleby speaking about the growing concerns over freshwater or groundwater contamination.
Māori grievances about land are historical. We didn't wake up in the 1970s all angry and protesty and, you know, started demanding our things back.
The Wire.
Following our earlier conversation with the Green Party's Huhana Linden, we spoke to Professor of Māori Studies at the University of Auckland, Margaret Mutu, about Shane Jones's announcement that he would draft a members bill to force Ngāpuhi into a single commercial settlement. Mutu said that while the bill's announcement wasn't uncharacteristic of the Crown or Shane Jones and their approach to treaty settlements, attempts to force Ngāpuhi into a single settlement claim would be met with fierce opposition, both by Ngāpuhi and Northland Hapu and iwi across the motu.
So to begin, would you be able to give us some background around the treaty settlement claims with Ngā Hapu or Ngāpuhi?
So the treaty claim settlement process itself across the country is something that the government has tried desperately to impose on Māori since the Waitangi Tribunal started upholding claims that more than 90% of the country was stolen from Māori, not only the land but also the resources that go with it. And it was in the early 1990s that Treasury did an assessment of the liability that incurred for the country. And it is the largest liability that this country carries. And every single government has been determined to shed itself of that liability as quickly and cheaply as it can. So this is a massive liability where you've stolen the power and the resources, including the land, of Māori, and you now have a debt round your neck that you've got to get rid of. So they've gone around the country trying desperately to get it. They started doing this in 1992, and 30-odd years later, they still can't do it. What they've done in the end is they have forced settlements on people, and I did a lot of research on this between me and Te Opeta McDowell. We did a lot of research on this between 2015 and 2019, and we found that almost all the settlements that have been done to date have been done under duress, and that they are to eliminate all of the claims legally and as many claims at once as they can. Now, this is where Ngāpuhi provides a marvellous opportunity for the government to rid itself of more than 100 claims in one fell swoop, because I think there's about 120 or 130 claims within the overall claims of Ngāpuhi. So that could rid the government of a massive liability, billions and billions of dollars in liability, if they can force Ngāpuhi into settling. Now, can they do that? Yes, they can, because the treaty claim settlement process has no legal framework around which it works. Most policies, almost all government policies, have a legal framework within which they operate, but not the treaty claim settlement process, which means that Māori have absolutely no power whatsoever in the process. And if the government decides it's going to write legislation to get rid of their claims, then that's exactly what they'll do. Now, they've not done it before because of the backlash that comes from iwi, and we all know that iwi are constantly protesting about their settlements, and you either see them in the streets or they're in the tribunal or they're in select committees protesting about the gross unfairness of the treaty claim settlement process, because every iwi, you're doing really, really well if you get 5% of the value of the land that was stolen for you. Don't even count in all the resources and all the other things that have been stolen off you. You're lucky if you get 5% back. Most get less than 1% back. And so there's a huge amount of bitterness out there. Now, to do it to Ngāpuhi will be, I would have thought, almost impossible, although, you know, government has no fetters on it. There is no written constitution in this country. A government can do whatever it likes. And if it chooses to extinguish all Ngāpuhi claims, it can do that. Whether it wants to pay the political price of doing that in Ngāpuhi, because Ngāpuhi will not lie down and take it. The treaty claim settlement process is the ultimate in the assimilation of Māori, and it assimilates Māori into Pākehā structural process. You have to set up a post-settlement governance entity that is controlled by the government. You have to cede your sovereignty. Now, I notice I'm quite surprised to see them say that openly, that Paul Goldsmith said that quite openly last week, that he would not accept a settlement that acknowledged that Te Whānau Apanui, in this case, had not ceded its sovereignty. Now, Ngā Puhi took a claim to the tribunal on exactly that point, and the tribunal upheld it because there is no evidence whatsoever anywhere in the country that Māori ever ceded sovereignty, and therefore the sovereignty remains. Now, this government is saying, well, Paul Goldsmith is saying he cannot accept that. Māori must cede their sovereignty, must accept that only the Crown can tell them how to live and what to do and how to be, or whether they can even be Māori in this country. And you should be very grateful, Māori, that we're paying you anything for what we stole off you, and we are the only ones who will determine it. It is the ultimate in colonisation. The treaty claim settlement process is the ultimate in colonisation, and Ngā Puhi has always been the iwi that has stood against colonisation and said, you are welcome to come and live with us, but we remain in charge of our own territories, and we have never ceded our sovereignty. So Shane Jones doing what he's doing? Yes, under Pākehā law, you can steal whatever you like off Māori and nobody will be able to stop you, not even the courts. But politically, if he wants a war with Ngā Puhi, this is the way to do it.
Just about a week ago, Paul Goldsmith said that the Crown was open to speaking with multiple Ngā Puhi groupings to achieve a settlement. So does Shane Jones's announcement come as a surprise?
Shane Jones's announcement doesn't surprise me or any of us who have been around since the 1990s. Shane Jones was the person they sent in when the fisheries settlement had been dragging through the courts for 11 years. They sent Shane Jones in as the bully boy to impose the allocation model on, you know, how the benefits from the fisheries settlement were to be distributed. They sent Shane Jones in as their bully boy. Shane Jones knows how to bully the people and will do so. Now, Paul Goldsmith is speaking out of both sides of his mouth. When he says he will talk to the hapū, it's not about the monetary compensation. Treaty claim settlements never provide compensation anyway. What they do is they allocate a certain number of millions of dollars and then say to the people that they've imposed that on, right, you can use that to buy back your own land at full market rates. So how much money they will give for that? Well, that's what they're saying, that that will only go to a central Ngā Puhi body. He'll talk to the other hapū, but it's really just to say, oh, so you want us to tell councils that you are mana whenua here. Well, of course, once you've ceded your sovereignty, you have no say anyway, but we'll write your name down in a letter to the Far North District Council and the Northland Regional Council to say you are mana whenua, but it won't mean anything. So that's all that is about.
Lastly, how do you expect Ngā Puhi and other iwi across the motu to respond to this bill if it makes its way to Parliament?
For sure, the treaty claim settlement process has divided Māori ever since it started, and I do not expect there to be much different here. I have spoken with many of the Ngā Puhi hapū over the years, and they are absolutely determined that they are not going to be assimilated into the Pākehā culture, because this is what this is about. Shane Jones is relying on the fact that he can impose a Pākehā model whereby individuals vote rather than hapū voting. He wants the individuals to have their say in a strictly Pākehā way of doing things. In other words, he wants Ngā Puhi to assimilate and forget that they are an iwi, to forget that they are whānau and hapū. I can assure you that whānau, hapū and iwi around the country are not about to give up who they are. They will fight. There's no question about that. I don't want my mind.
And that was Professor Margaret Mutu from the University of Auckland talking to us about Shane Jones's proposed draft members' bill forcing Ngā Puhi into a single treaty settlement.
That was The Wire.
Ko I rā te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki au mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Wednesday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. The Green Party's Huhana Linden, retired politics and international relations professor at the University of Auckland, Stephen Hoadley, professor of Māori studies at the University of Auckland, Margaret Mutu, mental health nurse practitioner, Anna Elders, and freshwater campaigner at Greenpeace Aotearoa, Will Appleby. Nei rā, hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakorongo ana. Thanks for tuning in to 95BFM. Next up is the Wednesday 1 to 4 with Bridge. Have a great day and keep it on the B.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.